Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We're forecasting prices that are coming off of the recent lows that we saw in 2023 and increasing a bit. However, they're not quite as high as the highest prices we've seen in the past 3 years.
Projections for dairy from USDA economist Michael McConnell.
Cheese is the one dairy product we're actually expecting year-over-year prices to be lower. But again, we're expecting the prices to come up a bit from the recent lows that we've seen in the past couple months. So with higher butter and NDM values, as well as broadly speaking, stronger cheese and whey, we're expecting class prices to be higher year-over-year as well. We expect the class 4 price to remain higher than the class 3. The value of butter and NDM continue to be relatively higher than the historical standards compared to cheese and whey. We're projecting an all milk price to be $20.95 a pound in 2024. It's higher than what it was in 2023, but not necessarily as high as we saw 2 years ago in 2022.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Outside the range of estimates going in. So maybe we missed the average by a bit, but still within expectations, generally speaking, due to the consensus from those who are providing those estimates.
Bob Mowers with Manduca Trading in Chicago on the latest WASDE report from USDA.
I think the takeaway was primarily neutral. And I guess if you were to dig into it a bit and try to emphasize some of the misses in terms of the average estimate compared to what the USDA came out, you would have thought it would have been leaning towards the bearish side for corn and wheat in specific in looking at the grain ending stocks here in the United States. And then also in terms of world production down in Brazil relative to corn and soybeans, you would have thought it would have leaned bearish. But as you can see by the way the market traded on Friday and then again today, kind of shrugged off any potential weakness from those numbers relative to the average trade guess going in and actually traded steady to better. So more of a neutral report, in my opinion. And in terms of the cotton market, beyond the corn, wheat, and soybean numbers, at least some of them I just mentioned, that was also showing a bit of the fact that the United States is rather tight in terms of its numbers, but the world numbers are still looking like there's plenty to go around the world. So the US is going to have its moments in terms of pricing the low crop supply scenario into the futures markets, which we've seen with some pretty good rallies that we've experienced of late. But nonetheless, when you sit back, that is, and kind of see how we're going to be able to do in terms of our pricing compared to the rest of the world, obviously we can't sustain some of those gains. And that's why we're seeing some pretty good whips to the upside and downside in the cotton market. The actual data that came out from the USDA showed that the ending stocks for the U.S. for 23-24 is 2.5 million bales. Average guesstimate going in was 2.72, so relatively bullish. Average yield was reduced to 822 pounds per acre from 845 in February. That obviously leans bullish. That pulls production down to 12.10 million bales from 12.43. That leans bullish. But in terms of the world ending stocks, to my point, they came in at 83.34 million bales, actually higher than the 83.31 million expected worldwide. So that's the scenario in specific with cotton, but dialing back to the grains and the oilseeds, I think a couple of the reasons that the market pretty much is trying to build a bit of a rally, you see that in corn in specific, the old crop May contract just a couple weeks ago was trading down to a low about 409, and now we're sitting around 441, so up roughly about 30 to 32 cents or so. And I think that's because a couple things. One is we got some pretty important reports due just in a matter of about 20 days at the end of this month, and those being the prospective planting report and the, you know, with the acreage intentions and also the quarterly grain stocks. So those are a couple of big data points that are coming up within a matter of a couple few weeks. And then also just this calendar beyond just the data that's coming out at the end of the month, but also the fact that we're going to be moving into a period where the planting's happening. And that is obviously going to be very important, and the biggest variable being Mother Nature. So market might be saying at this point that we need to start pricing in maybe not an ideal Edenic scenario for the grains and the oil seeds in terms of getting that crop in the ground. So it's starting to pull back a little bit on the extreme bearishness, let's put it that way. So we'll see how it all plays out.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We have had a fairly warm winter, right? And usually when we have this warm winter, as long as the crop is able to vernalize, meaning that we had enough weeks of cold temperature there, it can actually cause some early spring green up and the crop can actually start growing perhaps a little bit sooner than what we would like it to.
Kansas State Wheat Production Specialist Romolo Lolato.
In terms of vernalization requirement, right, just for everybody to be on the same page, but essentially winter wheat that we grow here in Kansas, it needs anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks where when soil temperatures are below about 49 Fahrenheit. And that definitely happened, right? So if we count back since November, December, we did have a number of weeks there of fairly cool weather. But overall, it was a warmer than average winter, especially towards the month of February there, right? And so this caused a lot of the wheat to green up around the state and caused some concerns around the with the growers as well.
And should we have cattle off of that wheat?
Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, right? It's one of the only regions in the world where we can graze the crop and then still harvest a grain out of that wheat crop, right? And part of that is because of this winter dormancy that we have, where the crop is not necessarily actively growing. And so it allows for some grazing out there. And part of that is also because our winters are fairly warm and they allow for more forage production, right? So if you go to colder regions, we also have winter dormancy, but we don't have as much growth, as much biomass, right? So it's a very unique situation that we have here in this part of the country and this part of the world, really. Now, a few things that we need to keep in mind there that are very important is we're not only looking at a forage crop and beef gains now, but in a dual purpose system, but also wanting to protect our grain yield later down the road as much as we can. And first, to protect that grain yield, removing cattle at first hollow stem is extremely important. Now, let's explain what first hollow stem is and then why it is important and then what can happen if we don't take care of that, right? But essentially, up until the crop starts greening up, there is no developing head in that crop, right? There's a crown, but in that crown, there's no developing head. Now, once it turns reproductive, right now, after winter dormancy, it starts to develop a tiny head in the bottom of that crown. And that tiny head is going to be pushed up in those stems, creating a hollow stem. So once that tiny head is underneath the surface, that's fine to be grazing the crop, right? Because it's not going to be, we're removing foliage, and that can actually cause a little bit of yield loss there, but overall, not much. But once we started actually, the developing head is above the surface as it's being pushed through in that stem, well, now the cattle is eating the developing head, and that really puts a ding in our grain yields on later on. So that's why it's very important. That's what first hollow stem is. It's like actually when we have about a centimeter of a, and a half underneath that developing head, so in between the crown and the developing head, and that translates to roughly half an inch or the diameter of a dime, right? And if we're grazing past first hollow stem, now the yield drag can be quite steep. It's actually, in fact, if we are grazing properly and removing cattle at first hollow stem or by then, usually, you know, we might have a 10, 15% yield drag in grazed wheat versus ungrazed wheat. However, if we're grazing past first hollow stem, now we're talking about 1 to 5% yield loss per day, right? And so if weather's cool and moist, but we're grazing past first hollow stem, we might be losing 1-2% per day. If weather turns out hot and dry and harsh, now we're probably losing up to 5% per day or so. So it's a very steep yield loss that we have if we're grazing past this very important stage of development of the crop, which is the first hollow stem.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I've recharted EPA's Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Federal Advisory Committee.
Speaking recently at Commodity Classic, the administrator of the EPA, Michael Regan.
And I've asked that committee to help ensure and evaluate how EPA's tools and programs can best advance our nation's agricultural, climate mitigation, and adaptation goals. By identifying voluntary, incentive-based opportunities, public-private partnerships, and market-based approaches, EPA can support farmers and ranchers in efforts to reduce emissions, sequester carbon, and also accelerate a more resilient food and agricultural system. Now, more than ever, both public and private sectors understand that agriculture has a unique and critical role in playing a contributing role in applying nature-based solutions to address climate change. And as Tom mentioned, we also, thanks to President Biden's leadership, have more resources than we've ever had before. In 2022, President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act into law, the most significant piece of climate legislation in our nation's history. The Inflation Reduction Act provided EPA with tens of billions of dollars to implement multiple new programs to help address climate-related challenges. For example, EPA's Climate Pollution Reductions Grant will provide over $5 billion to state and local governments to develop and implement greenhouse gas reduction plans. Among other strategies, we've encouraged states to consider how these very funds can help accelerate incentive-based projects for agriculture and working lands. This is just one more indication of how our agency, the EPA, is viewing the ag sector as a key partner in achieving all of our climate and environmental goals. And of course, another issue of significant interest to the agriculture sector is biofuels. Getting the Renewable Fuels Standard program back on track and back into a growth mode has been a key priority for me since joining EPA. Not only did the most recent RFS RUD include the largest volume in history, but it was also unprecedented because it included volumes for a three-year period, 2023, 2024, and 2025. This was based on the input from you all, from our stakeholders who have told us that longer-term targets are needed to provide market certainty to the agriculture, biofuels, transportation, and energy sectors as you all plan for future investments. This program continues to play a major role in diversifying our nation's energy supply, improving energy independence and security, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions, while supporting rural economies. According to our analysis, we estimate that this program increases revenues for farmers by approximately $19 billion per year. I should also note that EPA is fully committed, as Tom has mentioned, to the Biden-Harris administration's Sustainable Aviation Fuels Grand Challenge and the goal of producing 3 billion gallons of SAF by 2030. The SAF tax credit in the Inflation Reduction Act will help accelerate progress toward this goal while creating new market opportunities for our nation's farmers. That's a win-win for climate and rural America. So, folks, it's truly an exciting time for all of us in the agriculture sector and for our country. And I'm committed to working alongside every person in this room to meet the defining moment. Our mission is to protect public health and the environment. And I believe our mission goes hand in hand with supporting America's agriculture and rural communities. Clean air, clean water, and healthy soils are fundamental to the success of the U.S. agricultural sector, and we're certainly stronger when we all work together towards these goals.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The SEC's final climate disclosure rule doesn't contain Scope 3, which would have seriously burdened U.S. farmers and ranchers. Travis Cushman, Deputy General Counsel for Litigation and Public Policy with the American Farm Bureau, says the final rule is notable for what it does not include.
What it does not look like is the way the proposal was 2 years ago, which would have included Scope 3. Scope 3 would have required public companies to report on the greenhouse gas emissions of their supply chain, meaning that farmers would potentially have to be tracking all their emissions constantly. And anytime you sell a bushel of corn, you'd have to say these are how much of seven different types of greenhouse gases were emitted for every bushel I'm selling.
The final rule means Scope 3 is off the table for now everywhere except California.
This is a final rule. 2 years ago, the Securities and Exchange Commission put out their proposal, which included Scope 3, and this final rule has fully eliminated it, which we are incredibly excited and thankful for. In terms of what comes next, California recently passed a rule that would also require the disclosure of Scope 3 for anyone doing business in California. We also have sued California over this as well.
The Scope 3 victory is a result of hard work done by both the Farm Bureau and its grassroots members across the country.
This is an example of how well Farm Bureau works when it works together. It's advocacy, it's grassroots. We had our members send 20,000 messages, SEC and Capitol Hill, explaining to them how this could really hurt them. All those things together helped create this result.
For more information, go to FB.org. Chad Smith, Washington.
But how did the SEC get to this point? Mary Thomas Hart is chief counsel. National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
I think we provided the SEC with a couple options when we commented. The first option was, you know, just give us a carve out for all farmers and ranchers. That would have been, you know, pretty easy to interpret, but at the same time, you know, what is a farmer and rancher? Is there a size threshold? There were a lot of questions that came with that. And our broader and maybe more aggressive ask, which is what the SEC ended up doing, was just to eliminate all supply chain emissions reporting outright. So now not only are farmers and ranchers excluded from having to submit those reports, but anyone that's just a supplier to a publicly traded company is no longer required to file those reports. So I think, you know, the SEC really did try to keep it simple. They tried to make sure that there weren't a lot of follow-up questions about who needed to report and who didn't need to report. Instead of having to worry about all of that, they just exempted anyone that is in the supply chain of a publicly traded company.
But it wasn't just the work of NCBA. It was the work of producers.
Yeah, so this was a pretty big grassroots effort in addition to the work that we did in D.C. We actually got about 7,400 letters sent from individual cattle producers across the country to their members of Congress and to the SEC, showing disconcern and really exhibiting worry and presenting the risk that would be created by a reporting requirement like that. You know, I think that grassroots campaign went a long way in showing members of Congress the risk that would be created by a reporting requirement like this. And, you know, across the board, Republicans, Democrats, members of Congress, senators were all on board in asking the SEC to kind of pull back this really burdensome reporting requirement. And so, yeah, I think that effort from our producers across the country made a huge difference in getting us to this win.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I think that there's a few different concerns there.
Kansas State wheat production specialist Romolo Olato.
One of them is, the wheat is ahead of schedule, right? And so, and we're far away from our last freeze at this point in time, right? Usually it doesn't happen until sometime there in early May, late April, depending where we are. So one of the concerns is, well, the crop has had an earlier green up. If temperatures drop quite a bit again, right, which is still possible, can that cause some winter kill? And the answer to that is yes, it can. And it depends, of course, on how cold it gets and for how long those cold temperatures are sustained. But definitely winter kill is not off the table yet, because the crop has its highest winter hardiness when it is in the middle of the winter there in January, early February. And from then, as temperatures start to warm up, day lengths start to increase as well. Slowly, the crop loses its winter hardness. So it cannot handle temperatures on the single digits anymore, which would have been fine back in December, January, right? And so there is a concern with winter kill, absolutely. There's also a concern with, for some of the growers who may be grazing their crop, when to remove that cattle, right, also becomes quite important here. And finally, another concern would also be later on, if we have an earlier than usual spring green up as we are having this year, then an earlier than usual heading date as well, that crop could actually be more exposed to freezing temperatures around heading and flowering when it's very susceptible, simply because it might be heading out earlier, right? And that freeze damage around heading can be quite detrimental to the crop. So there are a few different concerns here that we are talking with, of course, a few of them more immediate than others.
So again, when grazing cattle on wheat fields, we need to identify first hollow stem. And how do we do that? Well, Olato explains.
How do we check for that? Well, you go in the field that is being grazed. It's very important. It should be field specific. But you don't go inside the fence, right? Because those plants are going to be grazed, and that delays development a little bit. You want to go outside the fence and pull a few wheat plants, look for the largest tiller, and split that tiller open lengthwise. And that's where you're able to see if there's developing head there, you're going to be able to see. If there's a hollow stem as well, you should be able to see. So just using a pocket knife, as long as it's sharp, you should be able to slice it open. And then having the dime on your pocket always helps us to see if we have if we are reaching that threshold or not. So once those plants on the outside of the fence are reaching for, they have not been grazed, right, are reaching first hollow stem, that's a fairly safe time to remove cattle from that specific field. Now, because the development of first hollow stem depends on soil temperature, depends on variety as well, it is field specific, right? It may happen differently in neighboring fields if you have different varieties, or in parts of the state where you have different soil textures, right? Sandier soil might warm up a little bit faster than a silt loam or a clay soil. And so there might be differences there as well. That's one thing to keep in mind, is it is field specific. So once that Mesonet tool is telling us there might be a chance to see some, I would suggest going out and check just outside each of those fields being grazed so that we can actually remove cattle at the optimal time and avoid any yield reduction from grazing past that optimal time for removing cattle.
Kansas State Wheat Production Specialist Romolo Lolato. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
In February specifically, only 18% say their household finances feel better than they were a year earlier.
Kansas State livestock economist Dr. Glenn Tonzer with a look at his latest meat demand monitor.
Why is that relevant for this meat demand discussion? Is geeks like me outside of this project would say that meat is an expensive item, and we tend to see meat demand grow with your income. And one step from that is if you're comfortable around your income and finances, meat demand is stronger. And we see that in spades month after month in the meat demand monitor. The part I highlighted in February specifically is those that say they're feeling worse off about their finances are spending quite a bit less away from home. So the change they're making is in think foot traffic and what they're willing to spend at a restaurant as opposed to foot traffic at a grocery store and what they're buying to take home. So they're making that pivot, and that aligns with what I just gave you a minute ago about the February versus January demand change. And they're making adjustments such as, you know, they might be trading down from steak to non-steak at the restaurant, or maybe they're having their steak when they go to the grocery store and they're cooking it themselves. Those kind of adjustments are cross-channel and cross-cut.
So that's a current look, but how does that compare to years past?
In February, I put out what I'd call special report. So we just got to talking about the standard 4-page monthly report comes out all the time. And periodically myself or Justin Beener or other PhD students that help me with this project here at K-State, we'll do one-offs looking at, you know, called a deep dive in all things that the meat demand monitor lets us look at. And we did that on this macroeconomic issue about financial sentiment. So you can find this report. There's lots of figures and tables in it. I'm going to draw a bow around it. But the reason I'm doing it now is there's a lot of discussion of, and this gets into, it's an election year, so it's coming up, about the state of the economy. You know, is the worst of inflation behind us? Will we have a second bout? Are my job, you know, or is my wages going to keep up with the higher cost of living? All those we've been talking about for a while, but they're getting elevated again. Now we're talking, you know, March of 24. So what I did was I went back and looked at all 4 years of data. So we have data from February 2020 through February 24 now, and we can look at this sentiment issue I was talking about. And quick reminder, by year, we were most optimistic as a nation in 2021. Looking at just the most recent 4 years. Not surprisingly, in 2020, when the pandemic hit, people were concerned. 2021, the pandemic got a little bit better. This is pre-inflation. We had federal government aid, you know, floating around, all those kind of things. So financial sentiment improved. Meat demand improved in 2021, and I detail that at nausea again in this report. But whether you were feeling better about your finances or not, all groupings had stronger meat demand in 2021 than 2020, which pulled up a lot of meat prices and with it livestock prices in 2021. That's the history lesson from there. Fast forward to the most recent 2 years, we've had slippage on household sentiment. So, and that's what I just broke down for February 24. The same thing on balance is held for the last 2 years. And the important part there is with it, we saw erosion of demand. So retail and food service demand that I just got talking about for February 24, we can look at it for the whole calendar year of 22, whole calendar year of 23. That's what we do in this report. And in 2022, we still had stronger demand by those that said their finances were improving, but not by the other groups. And by the time we got to 2023, all residents, regardless of their financial sentiment, were signaling weaker meat demand than in 2022. So think some staying power from this financial sentiment. Probably those that said their finances were doing better in 22 happen to have benefited more from the stock market rally in 2021, and or they had a job change that others didn't that made them kind of keep up the cost of living. So if inflation wasn't hitting them as hard, those kind of things are probably why they were in that position. And they were the main source of some staying power on meat demand in 2022. So 22 demand was sort of flat. but it was up for that group and down for the other, so it was flat for the country, is what I'm trying to impress on everybody. And by the time we got to 2023, that had all eroded, and it weighed on meat demand as we went through 23.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We will do everything we can to support farmers, ranchers, and impacted communities on the long road to recovery. Those words from Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in reaction to the devastating wildfires that have burned at least 1.3 million acres in the Texas Panhandle and western Oklahoma, destroying homes, farms, pastures, and livestock. Vilsack has directed the USDA to help in the recovery efforts. USDA already has 200 people on the ground helping with fire suppression and has people from USDA's Farm Service Agency and Natural Resources Conservation Service holding informational sessions outlining for producers the many programs that are available in the disaster situation such as this. Everything from emergency loans to programs to help producers who have dead animals to dispose of. Secretary Vilsack said full recovery from this disaster will likely take many months, and USDA will be there for however long it takes. Gary Crawford, Washington.